Joining me today on Drunken Lullabies Presents My Personal Mixtape is Greg Jahanian from Me Without You and his solo project Geology. Greg is the bass player for Me Without You and the chief songwriter for Geology. This was a fun episode because we got to talk to somebody who wrote half of the songs on his list and then played bass on the other half. So we had that split conversation of being the chief songwriter versus being part of a band and not the lyricist. Me Without You is a very interesting band that is tough to define. So if you're unfamiliar with their music, you're going to become very familiar with it over the next hour plus. This was my first conversation with Greg, and by the end, I felt like we'd known each other for quite a while. So without any further ado, here's my conversation with Greg. Enjoy. All right, joining me today is Greg Jahanian from the band Me Without You and also his solo projects. And past bands, we're going to talk about all of them. It is Greg's My Personal Mixtape. He selected 10 songs. I selected one as usual. And we're going to, over the course of the next hour or so, chat about all those songs and why they were selected. But Greg, thank you for joining me here today on the show.
Yeah, you got it. Thanks, Dustin. I appreciate you inviting me to come along.
Now, I know a lot of people right now that are in the music world, that, you know, there's no live shows. A lot of people are taking this time to do a lot of writing. And I think 2021 is going to see an onslaught of music releases because everybody's cooped up and sheltering in place and boredom sets in and hopefully inspires people and they get creative. This whole show came about that way. I wanted a new spinoff and wanted to chat music again. And this whole project was born out of late nights and COVID evenings. So
right on.
How has that been going for you? I know you just put out a new album earlier this month. So you do have some pretty fresh material, but, you know, do you have anything already in the works?
Yeah, so actually, it's funny. I spent, and, you know, I don't know if we'll talk about this more at a different point in the show, but relevant to your question, working on that album, usually with Geology stuff, kind of the way Me Without You writes, too, I would always kind of just carve out, you know, a month or two, and whatever was happening in my life, like, let that sort of inform a group of songs that would end up being an EP or a full length, to release on Bandcamp. And this time, this is the first time writing since my son has been born, who's four, just turned four. So,
oh, cool.
You know, yeah. So it's not as easy to, you know, I'm just gonna take, you know, spend 8 hours upstairs, like in, you
understandable
know, in a given month or two, and work on a batch of songs. So this is the longest it's taken me to complete an album. So I ended up writing about 15 songs and recording the music for them all, and then about 10 or 11 ended up with lyrics and vocals. And all that to say, when lockdown started back in March, I was doing a lot of Instagram live stuff, just doing covers and stuff. And then after that, I kind of felt the creative energy to, you know what, finish this thing. You know, it's been, you've been living with it for a while. And then also two of the songs that I ended up leading, like two of the, you know, I hesitate to use the word single for a project that's kind of as small and, you know, recorded at home. But, you know, the two songs that I put out prior to the release of the record were actually born of quarantine. So in a way, I felt this creative surge and felt like I could almost write a whole new record. But I had to kind of, you know, put the brakes on and call it done and say, OK, you know, these fit into what this vision is. And then I'll go from there. But to answer your question too, as far as nothing in the works, but I'm definitely feeling like, well, this some sort of version of a lockdown may be happening for a while yet in front of us, and certainly no touring. So all that to say, whether it's collaborating with other band members and Me Without You or my own stuff, I feel like there'll be a lot that comes out comes out of me, not that comes out as in released, but just, you know, sure. we'll see where that goes. But
what's going to be cool about this episode and make it differ slightly from some of the others is half of this list is going to be made up of your songs that you wrote, you sing, you perform, and then the other half are Me Without You songs where you are the bass player and contribute background vocals and other things, but you're not the lyricist right. for that band. So usually we have a lot of the, you know, the songwriters for doing lyrics and stuff like that. And I just think this whole conversation could be really interesting because we're going to focus on other aspects of the songs than just strictly lyrically based.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so you would normally have maybe the primary songwriter or singer of the band. Is that what you're saying? Like the conversation would usually focus
so
on that?
So far, that is how it started. I have several people on the list, and there several that are like you, you know, that, you know, it's going to be music-based for cool. the most part, but you're the first one to do the show so far, so awesome. Hopefully you don't screw it up and, you know, it works out all right.
No pressure, yeah.
So we'll start with the first song, which is my pick. Mm-hmm. We're taking it all the way back to 2001, released wow. on, yeah, Take Hold Records, The Operation, and... Right on. This is off of There Is Hope for a Tree Cut Down, and the song is Beaten by the Best.
And I try every day to do what only you can do through me. And I fall. And I hang my head in frustration.
Those who may not be aware, The Operation was the original band, and then several of the members ended up starting Me Without You, and it wouldn't have happened without this project originally, and that's where the journey begins. So I thought it was a good place to start. What do you even remember about The Operation days? I mean, we're talking... almost 20 years ago. I know I have trouble remembering, you know, that far back at times. So right. I'm sure it's the same way for you.
Yeah. Yeah. no, I I have a lot of fond memories around that time, but, yeah, that you're right. That was the band that, it didn't spawn Me Without You, but it was a handful of the members and sort of some of the connections that we made in that world through that band were sort of a catalyst or at least, overlapped with the world that Me Without You sort of eventually launched into with Tooth and Nail and Cornerstone and, you know, all the kind of going back to the sort of the roots of the band. Yeah, The Operation was interesting because I grew up with Mike and Aaron and the brothers that are Me Without You and kind of all the guys to a degree, but Mike, I've known since sixth grade. Mike and Aaron are brothers. Obviously, they've, you know, they've known each other for as long as they can remember. But
makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And then I met Chris, who was the guitarist on the first three Me Without You records in later high school. And then Ricky, I met not long after high school, but he's a little younger than the rest of us. So, you know, going back 20 years, that was more of a bigger age gap than it is now. You know, at like 43 and 38 or whatever it is. You know, it doesn't really matter. But... all that to say, I did a ton of bands with Mike and Aaron, that never did anything. We just would play in the garage and, you know, we'd write songs, we'd cover songs, you know, and maybe we'd play to friends or, you know, and that happened for years. And then The operation came about when I was actually invited to join a band with some guys at a college around here, just outside of Philly. And they had this band called Sans Culottes that was on Burnt Toast Vinyl, which is a wonderful Philly label. That's a good friend of mine.
Yeah, Scott Hatch.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, okay, yeah. So Scott's label put out one of our records. I joined, and it was with a couple of these guys from this college. One by one, one by one, they quit just to do other things. You know, one guy just wasn't going to pursue music. Another guy got married. The other guy, Marty, went on to, he moved back home and ended up, now he plays with Zayo. But so it was like kind of like, you know, so as they were quitting, I brought in my friends that I grew up playing music with. So Mike and Aaron, Aaron first, and then Mike, and then Chris. So at that point, you know, three-fifths of me without you, what would become me without you. And we kind of took over, and then the direction of the band kind of changed, and we only did two or three tours, but two of them were with the Juliana Theory. And when we played in Birmingham, we met Chad Johnson, who was running Take Hold at the time, and had some interest in the band, and we got to make that record. After we worked with Scott on a record and an EP, we got to put out a full length with Take Hold before the band disbanded. But yeah, but all that to say, out of that came Mike and Aaron's and Ricky's and a friend of mine, Ray, their interest in doing something like way more heavy and chaotic, which was not my style. I wasn't necessarily invited in, but it was kind of just like, yeah, that's not my thing, but like, that sounds cool. You know, and like, it was almost, it's kind of been said in interviews before about Me Without You, but almost started as a joke, or maybe not a joke, but kind of like, we're just going to kind of do this little chaotic, like, you know, fast kind of wild punk screamy stuff, and made this like homemade EP that didn't see too much of the light of day. But then when they went and recorded, I never said that I was brave, and that went on to get a little more attention. And yeah, so I don't know if that's a very long answer to your question, but that's kind of that's kind of the you know, like that was our time in the opera, and we loved it because we had done these bands for years. So then to kind of be able to do a few tours and go in the studio was a real learning experience for us, and really exciting at the time, and kind of shifting from the kind of poppier indie punk stuff that are like kind of pop punk, pop indie stuff that we did like in the mid to late 90s as the operation, into like kind of a heavier, like almost like, you know, Sunny Day Real Estate, like more that vibe, the kind
yeah,
of
I was
a little bit darker.
Was just getting into that in my notes I've got down, this is, I mean, a quintessential early 2000s, you know, what was described as emo sound. And I mean, you can hear the Sunny Day Real Estate influence on, especially in this song. And I mean, I chose this one intentionally because it's going to transition really well in a little bit. But, you know, there's a really great instrumental break that just goes into the peak of the song. And I don't know, like, even if you have never heard this song before, if you were in that scene, it is going to transport you instantly to all these memories of basement shows and sweaty right pits and all of that. It just, it's impossible not to have those memories triggered. And it's awesome. it's just a fun song that makes me think of my early 20s and yeah, felt like sharing it.
Show me how to fall in love.
No, I appreciate that. Yeah, and it's funny because that song, I will say that song from the kind of poppier stuff that I was writing, that was like, I had been into that stuff, but I hadn't tried to write it. So I felt like that song almost, I guess I'm proud of it in the sense of like, you know, I wrote it when I was, I don't know, 21 or something. But there's sure. a sense of like, but there's a sense of like, I was trying to write a sunny day song basically, and how mm-hmm. I would sing it or maybe how it would sound through the filter of the operation. So it felt like a transition for the band that we wrote that actually, it was on an EP before it was on the full length. So that was in a different batch of songs, but then it felt like an entry point to write some of the longer, you know, kind of mathy time, mm-hmm. you know, off time signature songs and that were a little darker and longer with a lot of instrumental breaks. So it felt like it's funny. You chose that song. It did for, you know, reflecting back, it did feel like a turning point in how the operation was writing songs. So it is significant to me in that way.
Perfect. Then following, we kind of already talked about it, but, you know, Me Without You, mm-hmm. that begins to take off. And the rest of the guys record a couple albums with Tooth and Nail. Now, you are not playing bass on the first two records.
Correct.
But later joined not too long after Catch for Us Foxes came out, if I remember right.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It came out, I think, in October of 2004. And I played my first show with them in January of 2005 and spent the fall learning, yeah, the songs.
How did the reuniting come about? And what were you doing leading up to that? Were you focusing strictly on solo stuff? Did you have a couple years where you just, you know, did your thing in your early 20s and lived life?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I kind of call those like my blob years, and not because I wasn't in a band or playing music, but even when I reflect back like 20 years later, almost 20 years later, those years like feel like I just felt like I was floating. Like when I look back, they just kind of feel like they morph into like one long, weird year that was like four
sure.
years long. I didn't feel like I really had a sense of self in the way I do now, or even a sense of, you know, vocation or you know, I didn't really know what I wanted. I felt a little untethered. So during that time, so the operation's demise, after the guys quit, they kind of quit one at a time. And like, I think Aaron might've held on to the end or not quite to the end, but tried to like make both things work. And I appreciated that. But when Take Hold got bought out by Tooth and Nail, mm-hmm. some bands were signed to Tooth and Nail. Some bands were just dropped and some bands were kind of in the middle, and we were kind of in the middle. So like, we had submitted a new batch of songs to Tooth and Nail, and they let us play their stage at like Cornerstone the year after that happened. And then we, you know, that kind of, it just sort of fizzled out. I didn't really want to do it with other people. Mm-hmm. And I was fine to just, you know, Me Without You was gaining momentum, and, you know, I was happy to, you know, just part ways in the musical sense. I mean, I yeah. lived with Mike at the time. I, you know, these are still like my best friends. It wasn't like we had gone separate ways in life, but all that to say, I think at the time I was working at a nonprofit. For those few years after the band broke up, I was kind of broke. I was like still living at home at that point in my early 20s. I had like no money. So I'm like, you know, spending all my days with friends and coming back and, you know, staying at my parents' house. And, you know, I just felt so untethered and lost in a way. And, mm-hmm. So I worked in like warehouse jobs. And I think at the time where I was asked to join, I was working at a nonprofit through like a temp agency. And I remember I was at my folks' house visiting, and Aaron had called me. And I thought he was just calling from the road just to say what's up, and, you know, and he told me that, you know, this was on a tour shortly after Catch came out, that Dan told the band he was quitting. And, you know, Aaron said, I would love to play music with you again. I would, you know, like if this is an opportunity for us to do that again, like, you know, can you think about it? And that was all great. I also had never played bass aside from like my own recording stuff. I never played in a band. But, you know, so it was kind of like one of those things where, and it kind of speaks to the band itself being relational in the sense of, you know, not only trusting me as a musician, but as a friend, to be like, all right, our band's gaining momentum. We put out these two records. You don't play bass, but you want to play bass in the band, you know? And I thought, you know, I think, I don't remember if I told him yes right then, or I said I'd think about it. But it didn't take me long to decide, like, all right, this might be a good opportunity. I'm kind of in a dead end job right now, and, you know, I need some direction. So I agreed to do it. And while they were on finishing that tour, I started, I lived with Mike, so I went to his room and got the two CDs, and then, you know, would just like practice throughout the day, you know, from the best I could pick up. You know, sometimes it's hard to hear the bass frequencies on a record when there's a lot going on. So yeah, to my best ability, I learned what I could, and then he came back from tour and showed me some stuff that he knew, and then I think I consulted Dan Pishock, the old bassist, on stuff that, you know, we were just kind of scratching our heads over. So yeah, so that there was a few months of knowing that I was going to be doing the next tour. But so all that to say, yeah, I was asked very soon after Dan quit, but I didn't do a show for a few months because, you know, there's a few months off for the holidays there.
And then album 3, Brother, yes. Sister, comes out 2006, and you were, you know, involved in the writing process of this one. And yes. The song we pick from this record is Oh Porcupine, which that is one of my all-time favorite Me Without You songs, so I was very pleased that this was included.
Without a queen, the locust swarm turned around black. Descending like a shadow of the tower on a fish's back. Sad little world. Then a speckled bird, humbly inspired, ran across the road. When it could have flown, it had made me smile. And at the water's edge, Babylon, as we lay and slept, the river wet. Would you, Zion, don't cry out? Bill, shake the sky, all creation groans.
Produced by Brad Wood, who had produced the previous record.
Yeah.
And how different was the writing process for this compared to, you know, when you were writing songs with those guys before?
Yeah. So very different. When we were writing songs before, whether it was The Operation or any, you know, any band in the basement that we would, you know, again, never play to anybody, but we were still writing a lot. That was always like, hey, I wrote a song at home. Here's how it goes. But always trusting the other to provide, you know, an accompanying part. Maybe sometimes that you had something in mind, but it was usually open-ended, but it was like, here's how the song starts, middle, you know, beginning, middle, end. All right, cool, let's do it. We were all kind of okay with that. That's just sort of how it went. And usually it was between me and Mike, because we were the guitar players in those bands in his basement and then in The Operation. So that was, you know, no one was really pushing against that, though. It's just kind of how it went. And then when it came time with Me Without You, I don't even know if I was like briefed on this is how we do it. It just felt like maybe at that point in our lives. Now we're like in our mid, you know, 27, like mid to late 20s kind of, you know. So I think there's just a different understanding on collaboration than there was
sure.
When we were 17, 18, 19. So I remember, let me think. You know, it was exciting, and again, I think it helped. I mean, if this was like a band that I didn't know the folks in, and it was
yeah, that'd have been awkward.
Sure, it would have been awkward, and who knows, you know, it could have been a disaster. But I think again, because that chemistry of friendship and musicianship was already pre-existing, you know, there was trust, and there was, you know, like creative or constructive criticism was welcome, you know, both ways. So I think I already felt. Strangely, it felt like home, because it wasn't like, oh, it's this new thing. It kind of felt like, all right, these are, you know, at that point I hadn't written with Ricky before, but with Chris and Mike and Aaron, it was kind of old hat. So in that way, it just felt exciting and fresh, because it's like, all right, now we're here again doing this. So what does it look like? In a sense, we approach it the same as far as somebody brings, instead of bringing a whole song, though, somebody usually brings a riff. So in the case of O Porcupine, in case Mike or Chris hear this, I forget who brought the initial opening riff. I feel like it was Chris. I could be wrong, because throughout a song, the way Me Without You writes, you know, there usually is different contributors to different parts of the song sometimes. And different contributors, like Ricky has presented guitar parts that have become songs. I've done the same, and you know, and vice versa. Or Michael come with a bass line, you know, so it's very collaborative in that way too. We mostly do stick to our instruments, but there's still an openness to what other people bring. And Aaron was even open to people bringing lyrics if they ever wanted to. And I just think we weren't interested, because I feel like that's such a unique, he has such a unique voice.
Yeah. Not, that's not tough to duplicate.
Yeah, exactly. But in what he says, even so, even for us to bring something, it just wouldn't feel like, yeah, it just didn't, you know, I always appreciated his openness with that, but it never felt like it was going to be executed well. So all that to say, yes. So it was a new, fresh, fun. I remember we started writing, I think, a couple songs in Ricky's basement before we rented a space down in another part of Philly to just like dedicate to coming to every day, like a work week, and just writing that record. And there was such an energy around writing that, it's one of my fondest experiences writing and recording, because there was, I just felt like we were tapping into something. And I don't say that in a grandiose way. Just, I feel like whatever was happening between us felt like electric at the time, if that makes sense.
Sure. No, totally.
So that, you know, and I feel like that translated, even in the way that we, I think, experienced the record as the band, I think it translated, a way that that surprised us, but that kind of made sense when it was all said and done.
And you mentioned you hadn't written with Ricky before, and now this is your rhythm section partner.
Yes.
Ricky he was just insane on the drums. I remember the first time I ever saw Me Without You live, it's tough not to watch Aaron flailing around the stage, but like, I'm a rhythm section guy, and Ricky was just going to town on those drums and playing with the sticks backwards, which I had never seen anybody do live before. And it was just like, holy crap, this dude is awesome. And
yeah, he's so fun to watch.
I'm sure did you guys just click and just get into a groove really well, or did it take some time to just adapt to his style of playing since you were new to the bass?
So what I think helped is that I pretty much, except for the first tour of Catch and maybe a shorter tour in the winter too, did the entire touring cycle for Catch Us the Foxes before we even started writing Brother Sister. All that to say, that allowed us to click. It did feel like it happened pretty naturally and pretty fast. Mm-hmm. But I think learning Dan's bass lines, which I love, it helped inform how I wrote too. Like, not only just the stuff, you know, that I like, or sort of the way that I hear rhythm, but, and I know I've found my own style within it, but it was helpful to be like, I'm not going to completely walk away from what Dan established, you know, as part of the sound of this band. And so it was helpful, you know, at that point it was just A to B Life and Catch. So, and we did a lot of A to B Life, but it was mostly Catch at the time, because that's what we were touring on. So in that year and a, what would it have been? About a year and a half, a little shy of that, of playing a lot of shows together and playing stylistically, like playing Dan's bass lines and letting that translate through me in the way that I was understanding bass and when to kind of give. I always loved bass lines that have a lot of space, and I kind of have embraced that sort of, like, you know, not like this kind of constant pounding rhythm necessarily, but
sure,
but
yeah,
but not only giving some melody to bass, but also the kind of start stop and, you know, I mean, a ton of bands do that, but, you know, even like a band like Fugazi is a kind of a prime example of, you know, a rhythm section that, you know, I think in our own way, me and Ricky have probably tried to emulate, you know.
It's not a bad thing.
Yeah, totally. So all that to say, I think to answer your question, so by the time we started writing Brother Sister, you know, now we had like, you know, I don't know, 14, 15 months of me being in the band under our belts. So that chemistry was there, that playing was there, and now it was just, what's it going to look like to create something new together? I think the first song we wrote together on that record, or at least a jammy version that became the song, was C minor. So okay. That felt like, I remember us doing that, and I was like, all right, this is kind of what it's going to be like. I think if we had just jumped into like, hey, join the band, now let's write, that might have been a different experience. But yeah, like I said, having a year plus of shows playing mm-hmm. catch, you know, over and over, allowed for an easier transition into the writing process of Brother Sister.
Yeah, for sure. Like it doesn't seem like there's any kind of, like, I don't know, it flows from the one album to the next. Right, that on. If you didn't know that there was a changeover, like the sound and the vibe of the band did not change at all. And yeah, I'm sure that's what awesome. You were going for, is the, you know, the quote unquote new guy. So yeah, like having that template and, you know, making your own tweaks, because that band was always evolving. People would sometimes ask me like, oh, what do they sound like? And I'm like, you just need to listen to them. I can't. It's like free verse poetry, but it's screaming, and it's over like sometimes hardcore riffs and breakdown. It's just and flowers thrown in the air, from on stage. So the reason I mentioned Sunny Day earlier is because this song features Jeremy Enoch on guest vocals. He kills it. When he comes, I get goosebumps every time he comes into that song. I think I'm getting him just thinking about it right now. But how awesome was that? Did he come to the studio with you guys, or did he unfortunately like record somewhere else and you just got the track?
I wish there was a cooler story. So I respond the same to that. Like when we first got the mixes back and heard it, we were like super giddy, and it almost felt like fake because he wasn't there with us, and
right.
That a little bit. But it was it's still to this day, and. That's even why I think I changed one of my songs I originally gave you to this one, because thinking of Sunny Day in relation to the operation, that band was a huge influence on
sure.
On all of us, to be honest, and Jeremy Enoch himself and his solo stuff, and you know, I love that early Sunny Day stuff so much, and so when we went to record with Brad actually produced the first two Sunny Day records, Diary and the Pink album or self title, whatever. And so I remember we were recording, I think we were just doing the instrumentals at this point, or maybe even pre-production. And we were like kind of joking, like, hey Brad, like, you know, do you have Jeremy's number? Like, how would he feel about being asked to, you know, appear on our record? We had no idea if he had ever heard of our band or mm-hmm. what he was up to. And Brad actually was like, that might not be a bad idea. You know, he's like, I can ask, can't hurt. And we were like, whoa. So, and it ended up, he asked them, and Jeremy said yes. And I think he had heard of the band. I didn't know how much he was familiar with anything, you know, but he was recording, I think, maybe even his second solo record at the time, if I'm remembering right. So he had to do it remotely from Seattle, from his studio, and send the tracks. So we didn't hear them until we were out of the studio. We were already home or playing shows, and then we would get mixes with him singing on O Porcupine and Dryness in the Rain. So that was very exciting, and still is, like, to this day.
Yeah,
like you said,
yeah, for
we,
sure.
We get excited because it's like, whoa. But I wish there was a cooler story, like, yeah, there we were in the studio, and me and Jeremy were talking about, you know, what it was like to write Diary, you know. But yeah, that didn't happen.
Well, it's still a cool story regardless.
Right.
And so as O Porcupine ends, it transitions, you know, right into Brownish Spider, but we're not playing that one. Instead, we're jumping to the album closer, which, again, one of my all-time favorite songs from the catalog, In a Sweater Poorly Knit.
In a sweater poorly knit and an unsuspecting smile, little Moses drifts downstream in the Nile. A fumbling reply, an awkward, rigid laugh, and I'm carried helpless by my floating basket raft. Your flavor in my mind is back and forth between, sweeter than any wine, as bitter as mustard greens. And it's light and dark as honeydew and pumpernickel bread. The trap I set for you seems to have caught my leg instead.
One, it is the best song I've ever heard that name checks pumpernickel bread. I don't think that happens very frequently.
That's a huge list. That's a high honor.
And also, fantastic harp solo. Again, something that is not utilized very much in the music industry, in alternative music, but man, it is so beautiful and just accompanies, you know, Aaron's accordion very well. Yeah. And it's also, I know we're not focusing so much on lyrics, but I do want to mention, in case some people are unaware, the album begins and ends with the same phrase, because at the end of the song, it just repeats, "I do not exist," which is the opening lines of the, you know, the album. So it brings it full circle, which I appreciate as a good album closer. But what do you love about In a Sweater Poorly Knit, aside from you get to shake a maraca like a beast on stage?
Right on. Yeah. I mean, performing it is, you know, it takes on its own life, and it's one of my favorites in that sense, because the physicality of shaking whatever's around me in the second verse, which is either, maraca or a tambourine. And, I have such a like visceral memory of that song coming together. And that was one of the few where Aaron, I think that and Messes of Men kind of were, you know, Aaron had this like, you know, four chord, you know, kind of folky or just like acoustic stripped down version of a song, you know, and that happened more on It's All Crazy. But for Brother Sister, it wasn't really the case as much as it was the traditional, we write instrumentals and then Aaron spent some time with it, you know, coming up with vocals and a melody. But all about to say, I remember we were kind of standing in this close circle in this little studio space, warehouse space we had rented, and we were writing Brother Sister. And I think it might have even been the chorus to that song. And I just love it. It's the two chords. It's A major to a C sharp minor. And I love the way that chord relation sounds. And then when we were doing it and Mike started doing his little melody line behind it, and the way Ricky was playing the drums and then the bass line, it's like simple, but I like the way it came together. It was just this sort of like, you know, I hate to use the word synergy, so maybe you could even edit that word out, because it feels like, it feels very like corporate for some reason, but it had, maybe energy is just a better word. There was just an excitement, and we were all like, it just felt so joyful. And I think there was something different about that. Like, I think like, not that that had not been in the music before, but there was something about Brother Sister that still had that kind of moodier part of Me Without You, but there was something, there was more joy and more hope that I felt, like even in the, when we were writing the instrumentals, than I had experienced as a listener slash, you know, touring musician on the previous records.
Does any of that come about because of you joining the band and maybe the energy you're bringing? Because I noticed it a bit as a listener that it's like, I mean, granted, you're in your, you know, mid to late 20s. People grow mm-hmm. up, people change, you start to mellow out. That's just the natural progression of life.
Yeah.
But musically, you know, there's still people making loud rackets into their 30s and 40s. We hear it all the time. But you guys did, you know, for lack of a better word, I remember reading reviews and it's like, oh, they're hippies now. And, you know, the screaming got toned down a bit and the melody was embraced more. And just based on your writing with the operation and that being more melody based, I wasn't sure if that was directly related to your influence in the process or if they were kind of already going down that road. And it just, like you said, it was a synergy and it just clicked.
Yeah, I think it might have been more that. I mean, I can't sit here and take credit and say it was, you know, I do think what I bring to either my own music or to collaborating is a more melodic sense. And mm-hmm. I tend to be drawn to music that has a lot of yearning and kind of hope in it. So I guess I could say for my part, you know, like whether that's specific bass line or just like what I bring as a musician, I guess I may have added to that, but I think it's more what you were saying, that was maybe already happening, even in a way that we weren't aware of or an unintentional. It wasn't necessarily, you know, sitting down and making this decision. It was just sort of the creative process. Almost, I think a good way to describe that excitement I was saying, it's almost like, you know, like birth or like any kind of creative energy that sort of feeds into something that's growing and then you're surprised by it. So it's almost like, that's what I mean. We're kind of tapping into ourselves and our kind of energy together. And then boom, this thing is sort of happening and almost unfolding in front of us. And we're kind of joyfully surprised by it, you know, and that's how it felt writing that song.
Set for you seems to have caught my leg instead.
One thing about that song is that when we left the studio, we hadn't recorded. I think the choruses may have been just instrumental at that point. Either that maybe the ahs were there, but there definitely wasn't the I do not exist. I think that's mm-hmm. what wasn't there. So we were on tour and we were with, I don't even remember, a couple of bands, but I remember one of the bands was Minus the Bear, and one of the members had recording gear. So he came on the bus because we had this idea when the record was being mixed. I don't remember. I don't want to necessarily take credit because maybe Aaron would hear this and say, wait, I came up with that melody. I feel like I came up with the I Do Not Exist melody, not the lyric, mm-hmm. but I don't remember. But I know that Aaron and I were like singing it together and like kind of harmonizing on the bus. And we were like, well, we should... You know, he was playing an acoustic. We were just in the lounge and we were like, we should put that on the record. It needs this punctuation. And he thought, yeah, to end the record, like you said, how it began would be a nice full circle. So this guy came on with his recording gear and recorded, you know, a version of us. We recorded that, those ending vocals, you know, on the bus outside of a venue and then sent it to Brad to mix into the mix.
Oh, that's cool.
It's a good move. Yeah. So, so that song again, so the way it felt and the way it kind of came together, and then yeah, like performing it is a joy, you know. So I think what one little funny note of that song too is the way the song ends on the record, it was almost an accident because we had like more of a production idea in mind, almost maybe of like it fading out like a parade would, or becoming sort of more AM radio or tin canny and kind of, you know, disappearing into the ether in some way.
Sure.
And we never, I think we just never went back to address it. So the way it's played, I like it in the sense that Tambor's beautiful harp line just kind of keeps going. Mm-hmm. I think everything kind of drops off, and then there's the bass as the last like rock instrument, and then that drops off, and then it's just Tambor's line. So it works out well, but that was not intentional. It was kind of like, no, we want this kind of parade feel. It was very kind of ambiguous, but and then we got the mixes and we're like, oops, we forgot to like address that in production. And so now the song just kind of ends with everybody stopping at some point. So, I mean, it's fine, but that was not like a methodical, planned out
okay
to the record. But
nice, yeah, little peek behind the curtain there.
Yeah, yeah.
So now we're going to fast forward to 2009. Mm-hmm. Sometime over the next 3 years, you guys decide to work with Daniel Smith of, yeah, Danielson, and that alone should let anybody know this next album is going to be a bit different.
Yeah.
And that album is It's All Crazy, It's All False, It's All a Dream, It's All Right, released 2009 on Tooth and Nail, and the song you selected from this is The King Beetle on a Coconut Estate.
As the moon rose and the hour grew late, the day help on the coconut estate raked up the dried leaves that fell dead from the trees, which they burned in a pile by the lake. Mm-hmm. The beetle king summoned his men, and from the top of the rhododendron stem, calling all volunteers who can carry it back here, the great mystery's been lit once again. Mm-hmm. One beetle.
So this record, a lot of people weren't ready for it. As I mentioned before, you guys are a band that could never be easily defined or put in a box. And if you were somebody was attempting to put you in a box, yeah, that box was going to get destroyed. And it was refreshing as a fan if you were comfortable with just going for the ride. Not everybody is comfortable going down the rabbit hole, but it's like, yeah, let's get weird. Let's get different. And this record definitely fits that vibe. I mean, this song, it's like medieval sounding. There's string and horn arrangements. And the lyrics in this album definitely went down a different road compared to the previous records. But what made you select King Beetle for your mixtape?
Yeah, so King Beetle was so for this, the way I was describing maybe that you traditionally writing songs, like, all right, we're gonna kind of write a group of instrumentals that, you know, have the Me Without You sound. I mean, you know, just because it's us writing it, not because we're trying to emulate the prior record, but just, you know, that it's gonna sound like us. Mm-hmm. Now we lost Chris as a member, so we're down one guitarist. So Chris decides to go to med school and become an emergency room doctor, which he eventually did and does now. And Brandon Beaver, who plays guitar now, was not in the band yet. So we're down to a four piece. A couple years have passed since writing Brother Sister. We are now each individually, the four of us remaining in the band, are going through our own crises, you know, relationship wise or sort of mental health relating to being in a band and touring. You know, there was just a lot of turmoil, but we were like, mm-hmm, it kind of just felt like, all right, this is when you write. It's like two plus years have passed since writing the last record, so it was already like a little disjointed going into it. But we approached it the way we had previous records. So okay, we're in the basement, we're gonna hash out these riffs and these songs. And some of them, when I listen back to the demos, like, it's like, well, what were we, you know, we kind of laugh at it. And some of them I thought were pretty cool. All that to say, we had like our traditional group of like 11, 12, 13 songs like for Aaron to now take and write lyrics to.
Okay.
I'd say about almost half of them, let's say four or five of them did become songs on the record. And that would be like a Goodbye Eye or Every Thought, Bullets of Binary Part 2, and maybe I might be forgetting one, but there was one or two more. But for the first time, Aaron was unhappy. He was trying to vibe with some of the stuff, and you know, you can't force it. So I think with all the things we were going through, and he was like, look, I just have some of these acoustic songs that I wrote, just again, like 3-4 chord folky, you know, mm-hmm. that would be a la King Beetle, David, stuff like that. When he sent those along via email, and we listened to them at home and basically wrote part. We'd never done something like this. We'd always been in the same room. So for me to be at home and get an email with like a raw version of Aaron and an acoustic, or maybe there was drums at that point. Maybe Ricky had done a drum track that Aaron played over or something. So I'm like, okay, my turn. And then I would wrote a bass line, you know? So in that way, it was kind of strange. And we sure. would all kind of, you know, give the thumbs up if we kind of like what the other did, but and things changed a little bit in the studio. But yeah, when we went in the studio, it was the first time we were now recording in Philly. And we worked with this fella, Brian McTeer, who kind of helped in the production end and did the engineering. And then certainly Daniel, we respected him as an artist. And yeah, like you said, we kind of knew he could maybe bring some kind of pull something out of us that was a little different than what we had done before. And that wasn't the intention. I know it sounds cliche, but it wasn't like, how are we going to write a subversive record? You know, in a way it felt mm-hmm. like, no, this is what comes next. It just felt natural. So it almost, I had to kind of catch up with the backlash. And it was almost in hindsight that I was like, oh yeah, I guess this album does feel different. Strangely enough, it almost sounds like it would, you know, smack you in the face as you're making it, but it really wasn't to us. And, but yeah, all that to say, King Beetle, the content, the mood of it. And then especially when, oh wow, I'm drawing a blank on the fellow who arranged all the strings and horns. Very, very, very talented guy that we worked with on the next record too for a little bit. But and I apologize for forgetting his name.
My vinyl copy next to me, I'd look up in the liner notes, but it's yeah. in the other room, unfortunately.
it's just escaping me right now. So if you are listening to this, forgive me. Anyway, he wrote these beautiful arrangements to a couple of the songs, and this being one of them, wrote these very lush strings and these kind of playful, you know, woodwinds and horns, and it just added. I remember getting the mix back, so Brad ended up mixing it, and so when he, you know, taking Daniel's production, this fella's arrangements on top of, you know, this, I think this beautiful song, I love the content and I really resonate with you know, I guess theology, if you will, of the song and sort of this mystic union with God, this sort of oneness that comes through you know, becoming the thing itself, you know, in this case the fire. So I remember getting the mix, it was funny enough, like I described, like In a Sweater Poorly Knit is this energy in the room as we're writing it, and this was more as I'm sitting at my computer. I lived actually with Chris and his wife and a bunch of other friends in this community house in Philly, and I was like, oh wow, this sounds really cool. It was so it kind of like I was almost being surprised by the song that we had just recorded, because I kind of just had heard my part, you know, and I think I even played some of the acoustic guitar on that song just as overdub.
Oh,
so
okay.
It was also like kind of piecemeal. I think because we were recording in Philly, I just like would go on my own and do a thing. So in that way, it felt more disjointed, the writing of that record. But that song, I wish we played it live. And I think if we did, or hopefully when we do a farewell tour, it will rear its head again. But, it's hard to pull off live because it's so long and we don't have all the other elements that make it really come alive.
Right, you'd have to have a backing track or something for it.
Yeah, yeah. So we can kind of make it its own thing live again, I hope. But yeah, anyway, I put that on the list because I love the story within it and the way, I remember the way it surprised me when I got the mixes back.
The Beetle King slammed down his fist. Your flowery description's no better than his. We sent for the great light and you bring us this. We didn't ask what it seems like, we asked what it is.
His Majesty's hour at last is drawn nigh. The elegant queen took her leave from his side, without understanding, but without asking why. Gathered their kids to come bid their goodbyes, and the father explained, "You've been somewhat deceived. We've all called me your dad, but your true dad, not me. I lay next to your mom, and your forms were conceived. Your father's the life within all that you see. He fills up the ponds as he empties the clouds."
Now we're gonna put the spotlight back directly on you, because for song number 5 from the Three Birds EP, this was released in July of 2010, we have our first geology song, and you selected Living Things. This was your second solo collection. I think you had like a demos and almost like basement tapes type of compilation that came out ahead of this. But this was like all new stuff, kind of all at the same time. You know, it's lo-fi folk. I Guided by Voices is one of my favorite bands, so I love that lo-fi sound. And like that in the room style of percussion. That it hits a sweet spot for me. So, awesome. You know, we had already addressed that, you know, your solo stuff and the operation was more melody based, and that it's definitely apparent listening to this versus some of the other tracks that, you know, we just played. What about Living Things makes it the first solo song that you wanted to throw onto your mixtape?
Yeah, I think it was kind of like you said, what I released under the Geology moniker before that was a collection of 2 years of just writing, you know, oh, I have a song idea, let me write and record it, and then would, I think, put it maybe even on MySpace at the time or whatever sort of the vehicle was to...
Yeah, there we go. That's a callback.
Yeah. Hoping someone would have it on their profile as their song.
Yeah, right, but, when you go... Yeah, that's the song that plays.
Yeah. No, but but this was the first time I like you just said, I don't need to repeat it all, but okay, I'm going to sit down and kind of take this like month or two of my life and sort of reflect on what's going on and what's churning and what wants to come out. And at the time there was so that song was born of a breakup, as a lot of songs, you know, are. And,
sure.
But why it was significant to me, not only do I am happy with the way the song came out, like the melody and even, the way the recording sort of fell into place haphazardly in a way, but kind of like you said, like me, I was hoping it kind of had this charm of, like you said, being in the room. So with that song, long story short, I think it was like kind of the end of a cycle of the way that I was relating to myself and to another in a relationship. And I remember having like a real breakthrough with putting a lot of pressure on the other person to not, you know, abandon me or to kind of fill the space in me of, you know, almost putting a pressure on a partner to, you know, make me happy in a way, you know, or hoping that it would. And I know there's like a lot of kind of cliches and I'm being vague in a way, but there was a sense of, there was like a death that happened in that breakup, a figurative death within me that felt like there was some kind of change. I think I was about 29 when I wrote the song, and I didn't get married till I was 37. So I had a couple of relationships, adult relationships in my 30s that sort of were these learning experiences. And this felt like the first significant one.
Okay.
And so I, the song being born of that and sort of this idea of resonating with living thing, just like, you know, the created world or just even the landscape within myself that is infinite and endless and sort of exploring and reverencing the other's landscape instead of, you know, trying to plant my flag in it and maybe overstep my bounds. I mean this in an emotional way. I'm not wanting to make myself clear. And this sort of, you know, maybe putting, like I said before, putting too much on another to bring mending to my own broken self. And so the song, even though I like it for what it is sonically, and it's a song I would always do live up until I did my last Geology show, whatever, like a year ago or so. So it always stuck with me. But there was something significant about the creation of it, that it kind of came out of this, like I said, this sort of death, that was very significant to me. So that's why I chose that one.
We're gonna do a twofer. we're gonna go right into another Geology song, and cool. A couple years later, about a year and a half or so, The Neighboring Sea is released, and you picked Song of the Wren, which has a very atmospheric beginning to it, and you know, transitions into almost like a galloping type of chorus. And I really enjoy this one a lot.
All right on.
Song coming from a little bit better of a headspace, you know, 2 years removed.
Yeah. So I picked this song. It's funny looking at the three Geology songs. They all, I love what they became musically, and they all kind of carry with them the significant experience. So Song of the Wren was born of, I was at actually this retreat. A friend of mine at the time was putting on. She was becoming a spiritual director, which is something that I do now after going to seminary. But so we spent time at this retreat center, that, and I believe it was a Catholic, maybe a Jesuit retreat center, and walking around the woods that evening, just trying to be quiet and kind of still myself, and I came across this like little grove and this little statue of St. Francis, and it was just this peaceful, it almost felt like this otherworldly moment, not literally, like I didn't have like some sort of, you know, vision or psychedelic experience. It was more just this resonance from within that was like, I don't even know, but there was just something, like there was just a clarity in that moment of feeling like known or resonating with something very deep. And I think even being among, again, the created world, it almost felt like everything around me was kind of dancing in like a moment. And I don't know how else to put it. So, but that's what it felt like. So this song is very short lyrically, and it kind of just describes, being in that grove. And, there was actually a statue of Mary too. And I think one of the lyrics is like the Blessed Woman. References okay. The Blessed Woman, and that's mm-hmm. her. So that's kind of what geology songs feel like to me. It's like taking these little snapshots of something emotional or spiritual, I guess, if you will, and trying to describe it, I guess, in language that maybe with nature imagery in it, or, you know, I don't like to be too explicit or too kind of like theological terms or even religious terms, even though I identify as a Christian and very much vocationally lean into that part of myself, but still, mm-hmm. I think language is important, and I think there's something beautiful about, you know, expression with more ambiguity and mystery than you know, I'm not trying to tell someone how it is as opposed to just describing something that resonates with me. So, but what I love about that song musically is that I think it kind of changed my direction a little bit with geology to kind of include almost like a more synthy. I used an Omnicord, which I got at a thrift store about 25 years ago, and okay. I kind of gave this sweeping synthetic lush sound, like mm-hmm. It with that galloping part you're describing that actually made its way into Later Me Without You songs, which one of them's on the list, so I'll wait to say it, but that instrument kind of it made geology a little less folky and in the room and a little more atmospheric. It was kind of a pivot point for me. So I think that excited me when I wrote the song. I was like, whoa, this is like two chords. This whole song's two chords, but these changing elements kind of opened up the way that I write a little bit. So
cool. And you mentioned about being more simplistic lyrically, which I actually kind of appreciate that. Especially like, cause the listeners are experiencing the duality of geology and Me Without You. Whereas Aaron is just hyper poetic and very yes. verbose, and sometimes so much so that unless you really sit down, focus, read the liner notes, you miss half of it. And you know, like there are things I pick them up and it's like, I've heard this song more times than I can count. And I don't remember that line, but,
happens so to me too.
Yeah. So I do like that there's, you know, more of a, I can say what I need to say, but just finely tuned. Because I do enjoy lyrics, and I like writing, but sometimes it's more about the music and the vibe and the atmosphere that it creates, and I'm more about the melody. That yeah. sometimes the lyrics can almost be secondary for me, which I find it's understandably like disrespectful, I know, as somebody who appreciates good writing, but it's a fact, and I sometimes have to be in a certain headspace to digest all of that lyrical content. And it's not always something you can just throw on in the background and casually listen to. You have to invest, like, all right, let's get heavy. Let's do some introspection. Let's go on
the dictionary, the thesaurus. Yeah, right. Yeah, the encyclopedias, a lot of like historical references in Aaron's lyrics. And
if you're following along on Genius, you know, you're going to be opening up a bunch yeah. of tabs and stuff.
yeah.
So I appreciate the way this playlist is structured, that, you know, we're kind of like toggling back and forth, and I think it makes for a really interesting listen. So
cool. Cool.
Well, now we're going to get verbose again because we're moving on to 10 stories released in 2012.
Yeah.
Me Without You. And this is my favorite track on the album. It's Grist for the Malady Mill. So, again, super excited that this was on the list. Smith again. This is a full-on concept record.
Yeah.
This song specifically has more of that old school Aaron's gonna scream some in the song, and it's a little more chaotic than those folky songs on the last record.
Yeah.
But this album, I feel if it came before It's All Crazy, that they would almost flow and transition more naturally.
Mm-hmm.
That I feel this one pairs better with Brother Sister than the predecessor did.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting you say that. I both agree and disagree. It's funny, in a way this goes without saying because it came after It's All Crazy, but I almost see that this couldn't exist without It's All Crazy, because It's All Crazy went so far, and again, not even intentionally or to be subversive, but went so far in one direction that even our return to form dragged with it those elements. Certainly,
exactly.
The kind of folkier, you know, more melodic songs, less screamy. And that would be a better question as far as the screamy singy for Aaron. That's
come
up so many times. I mean, when we write, there's so many kind of funny debates. You know, someone brings a riff. Well, Aaron, I hear, like, you know, even maybe months before Aaron even comes up with any words or melody or idea vocally, it's like, oh, well, I hear you. Maybe you scream in here. You know, and sometimes Aaron then will feel pressure. Do I have to, like, write a screamy song? You know, so those terms have been thrown around so many times in the writing process. Even it's funny when you say it's a concept record, it's like I can't unsee it that way. But when we wrote it musically, like I said, like any other grouping of songs, that was,
they're instrumentals. Yeah.
Yeah. They're instrumentals. So it's like, these are what, however many songs it was, 11, I think 11 or 12 that we took in the studio. And, or 13, cause a few of them were B-sides, but Aaron writes these lyrics. Oh, it's a concept. Okay. Yeah. No, that's cool. Let's see where it goes. And then, you know, then the songs take on a new life after we had already lived with them instrumentally for, you know, sometimes even close to a year. So for Grist, but I hear you. I remember even at the time thinking this feels like more of a relative of Brother Sister than It's All Crazy. And then I felt that even more when Pale Horses came out. But with Grist, this was actually a Ricky riff.
Okay.
At least maybe most of it was. I know the main riff that starts the song and sort of drives the verses was a Ricky guitar part that we, you know, sort of then adapted a little bit into, you know, a broader Me Without You song. So what I love about this song, funny enough, I love playing it. I love Ricky's drums. I like that the bass line is especially in the verses, is very just like melodic and kind of high up on the neck, and that's always fun for me to do something like that rather than just playing a root note, which is called for sometimes too, you know. But so there's the element of performing it is enjoyable, and But for me, funny enough, what resonates the song the most is it sounds to me like an old R.E.M. song, and R.E.M. is one of my favorite, like maybe in my top three, like especially
okay.
Like pre-95, you know, like 1983 to 1995 R.E.M., like that they sort of had their, you know, especially in their early years, the IRS years. Yeah, the IRS stuff, you know, like the you know, almost like definitely like a punk ethic to it. And
sure.
I always felt like we shared, you know, it's funny, like when you listen to Me Without You and R.E.M., I don't think you would put them side by side and see a direct correlation. But we always used to even talk about it with ourselves, almost like some of the spirit of what we were doing hearkened to some of that, among a lot of other things that influenced us. But I think me certainly, and I know some of the other guys too, that, you know, they're an important band to us. But again, the IRS stuff and the early Warner Brothers stuff. So like, this song feels like an R, and I even approached the background vocals like that, the way like Mike Mills would sing with Michael Stipe.
It's one of my favorite things about R.E.M. is the Mike Mills background vocals. Like,
right?
It's so good. So good.
So good. And he would do these counter melodies, and I love that. So this also not only did what Ricky wrote and then the way it kind of vibed felt like an R.E.M. song to me, but then in thinking about when Aaron had the lyrics and we were in the studio and I was coming up with some background parts, it felt like a fun way to kind of channel Mike Mills. So you know, I definitely resonate with the song in some deeper ways, but that's why I chose it. On that record, it feels like a song, like you said, it harkens back, but it still feels like it's moving forward.
But sir, criticize them, you must.
And it's interesting you mentioned R.E.M. Like, I've been a fan of them for a really long time, and yeah, I've never thought of them in the scope of being an influence on you guys. But now that you've said it, I don't know how I didn't think of it.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of feel stupid. Like, well, yeah, duh, that makes perfect sense. But
yeah,
that you just had, I had a revelation here just now. So thanks for that, Greg.
Funny. Yeah, no doubt. Happy to enlighten.
All right. Well, now that my mind's blown for a little bit, let's move on to song number 8. We're going to go back to Geology. And this is the title track from North, which was released in July of 2013.
In the driveway away from your house, back to the cold seat of my car, the blue light from the moon above lit my way, in between red clouds moving fast and far. Did you ever look up and notice the color of the night winter sky? Rusted out roof of an old garage, I watched a dove descend upon a broken place. I walked north on the day we were born. I walked north.
this is the album closer. If you go on the Bandcamp page, you can get all the Geology stuff. It's all on there. I believe most of it is, you know, subscribing to that old Radiohead ethic of, you know, pay what you want.
Including free. It's all available for free or pay what you want.
So I highly encourage everybody to check this out, because these Geology songs are not on Spotify. Now, I make a companion playlist for these episodes, and half, well, not quite half, but a lot of this one is going to be missing. But you guys, if you're liking what you hear in the episode, go check it out, and you can hear the whole songs and their companions on the albums. It's all good stuff. So that's just me instructing people to do that. But you have the lyrics for this song, but you only include the chorus. You actually don't have what is, in some ways, sounds like Aaron's vocal delivery is kind of influencing you, because the verses are pretty much like spoken word.
Yeah. Oh, it's funny. I almost maybe like your REM revelation. I never put that together, that it is, because to me it is a melody, but it is very it's almost like you said, like spoken or kind of almost whispered, not Aaron delivery, and as in like as in a more aggressive but I remember almost whispering the, you know, the vocal take. That's interesting. Now I see that. But so for that song, again, like a lot of these songs that I picked, it's like remembering what it felt like to write it, and feeling like I'm tapping into something within myself. Again, not making it this larger than life thing. Like I'm tapping into something, you know, like it's more like, oh, there's something, you know, that's striking a chord in me. And it's kind of coming out in this way. So without sounding too cheesy, you know, almost like the song feels like it's kind of writing itself, even though I know that's not really what's happening. But for North, it was a time where I was falling in love with my now wife, Marley. And I guess maybe when I wrote like pop punk songs when I was like 16, you know, it was a little more explicit, like explicit meaning like, you know, singing a girl's name or talking about that.
Sure.
But North, was sort of my love song to Marley, or it maybe if not to her, certainly about that experience of falling in love before I really knew it and before I even told her. And funny story, she sings on the chorus, her and my friend Danielle. But it was when we were first starting to hang out. We had like mutual friends, and our friend was, I don't want to say like setting us up, but kind of like, oh, come hang out. And like, I was like, oh, I'm working on these songs. And I knew that she sang. So I just brought like my microphone and my friend and her. I was like, do you guys just want to like sing this line on this chorus? You know? So, and I remember she heard the verses, which I don't include the lyrics, and I think she told me later, kind of like, wait, aren't you describing like one of our hangouts at like an arboretum, like before we like really got together, and I had to confess that I was. So I don't include the verses, not necessarily because I thought Marley would read them before I pursued her more, or before our relationship kind of opened up more. But sometimes I've seen other lyricists do that. I don't know why I did it. I think it felt very personal. So in a sense, I liked just putting the chorus up. But yeah, but both verses, the first verse kind of just describes driving to her house in the winter and being cold, and kind of how I felt, you know, leaving the house or sitting in my car looking at the sky, you know, just these little, again, like little kind of vignettes, these like little moments. And then the second verse was a time we kind of went on our first like quote unquote date at an arboretum and walked around these trees and these tree houses.
Above the forest floor, have I sat too far away? I couldn't hear what the animals hear, but in this house of sticks here I could stay. I walked north. Tree.
So, you know, they felt personal, but it wasn't like a, I don't want anybody to know what I'm saying. It just kind of felt, I don't know why I wanted to represent it that way lyrically. It's interesting you brought that up, but it was intentional, but it wasn't like a, I don't want people to know what I'm saying. I think it just felt more, even as a punctuation to the record, calling the record North, and sort of the, I remember writing the guitar part. It's a very simple song. If anyone hears it, it's just this little guitar arpeggio with kind of a floor tom, like a little driving, and the omnichord again makes an appearance, and sort of this lush chorus that, again, makes sense emotionally to me. But when I read even the lyrics, I don't even totally understand what I was saying, but it felt like it came out. So I just kind of went with it and trusted it. But
I like that it's included, and getting that backstory makes me like that it's included even more.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, it's a really cool story and moment revolving around this, and that's what this show is all about.
Right on.
You know, hearing those stories and getting that insight, and you know, not always the songs that the fans would necessarily pick as like their top 10. You know, like, no, let's shine the spotlight on the ones that aren't getting the attention that the artists feel they deserve, and the ones that hold the special meaning. So that was the whole reason for this show to exist. So yeah, I love getting to hear this kind of stuff.
Oh, awesome. No, I think that's a great concept. That's what made me really excited to come talk to you, because it's such an interesting concept. And I had to even kind of fight the urge to be, you know, because I think my newer songs sound better sonically, or maybe even are like, you know, better songs in a sense. Mm-hmm. But I really had to taking your direction, kind of be like, well, yeah, but what, like, what resonates, or what, you know, why would I choose this?
They're
one
too new,
one?
You know. Yeah, maybe we can do another one down the road, and you know, like an EP instead of a full length.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I listened to all these songs on headphones multiple times while I'm you know, preparing for the episode, and there is something going on in the background of this song, like when the bells are going, and I'm trying to identify what it is, because it almost sounds at times like a chair creaking, but it also could be a percussion instrument, and I'm not sure.
Yes, I know what you mean. That was the snares on the snare drum. I was sitting there listening to it, and again, when you described, I like that phrase, that kind of in the room feel. I had the snare drum turned upside down and had a room mic, and I just to see what it sounded like, I ended up keeping it. I think I had it turned over, and then was just sort of brushing my fingers along the snare and kind of making it like almost this more unsettling sound, like, oh, what is that, or something that's
gotcha.
Not too distracting.
Okay.
But yeah, so that's interesting. I totally forgot about that until you brought that up. So
yeah, I like weird things like that.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, it's cool being able to now visualize what it is that I'm hearing.
Awesome.
To close it out, three straight songs from Me Without You, released in June of 2015, Run for Cover. Yeah. You guys are no longer on Tooth and Nail at this point. Mm-hmm. And not working with Daniel Smith for this record, you worked with another notable producer, Will Yip.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did he bring a different type of energy to the recording process?
I think he totally did. I forget if he came as a suggestion from the label, because I know he works with a lot of Run for Cover bands. I don't remember exactly how it came to be. And obviously, he's in Philly, so that was already like a plus, because we didn't want to leave home as our families were ever growing by this point in our career. So, excuse me. So all that to say... yeah, I don't remember exactly how that came about, but Will definitely did. I having then checked out some of the stuff that he had produced, there was a live feeling to it that I think, you know, I'm happy with the production of all the records, and I love hearing the sort of the signature of each producer we work with.
Mm-hmm.
Will was able to, kind of pull out this more live, energetic feel from the band that we were, I think, looking for, maybe even on 10 Stories. And yeah, that live thing I'm talking about, I think was captured better on Pale Horses. You know, they're different animals, those two records.
But, sure.
But yeah, so Will was definitely able to do that. And especially with the amount of time we spent in pre-production with Will and playing through the songs tirelessly, you know, in the room that we were going to be recording in. And I think that, and Will will definitely... not settle, Not that the other producers did, but he's almost notorious for like, all right, let's do it again. That was almost there. Let's do it again. So there's a lot of, you know, blood, sweat, and tears that come out of working with him. But I think, you know, the result we've been happy with, and the reason even I picked songs off Pale Horses, for folks that don't know, but I took time off the band when they wrote and recorded Untitled. So although I did the whole touring cycle for that record, so sometimes I forget I didn't record on it, but I was not, you know, I think I'm proud of those songs as far as output from the band, but that's why I didn't pick any of those, because wasn't a part of the.
So yeah, we're having a trifecta from Pale Horses, and it starts with the leadoff track, Pale Horse. Of some of the band members, and it seems there's a different lyrical approach. It's not as, I guess, ambiguous. You can kind of figure out what some of the songs mean without doing as much research.
Yeah,
there's a lot of death imagery in the songs. How did this song make its way onto your list?
So, yeah, even like you said prior, or maybe after we talked about North, you know, the idea of maybe you picture like a musician picking the bangers, you know, the ones that like, you
right.
know, and the
nothing
song
but being, hits.
Yeah, nothing but hits, you know. So Pale Horse, you know, probably wouldn't fall under that list of the most listened to song on iTunes or whatever from, you know, for Me Without You. But I love the way it came together. Actually, I think it, I'm trying to remember what came first. If we wrote D minor, which the end of this song, the end of D minor, is sort of a relative of Pale Horse. And I can't remember if we wrote Pale Horse and then kind of brought it around to the outro of D minor or vice versa. But regardless, what I love about this song instrumentally, when we, funny enough, we did write it. It almost sounds like it could just be kind of been a studio creation, but we intentionally had like Mike's, you know, melody that comes in with over Beaver's chords. And I love songs where, again, not having played bass that long, I get to kind of be, and on records too, but sort of like the atmosphere guy. So like I have a lot of, I have like a sampler, and then I'll like trick that out through like delay and reverb pedals and kind of, you know, oscillate the tempo, you know. So when we do transitions live between songs, like I get to use like that kind of stuff on my pedal board. So
yeah.
I got to play with some of those things, and they're kind of faint in the background, but I love where I get to do some of that, 'cause as a bass player, you don't get to play with that stuff too much, but that's kind of one of the roles I've taken on in the band. So
that was actually something I forgot to mention when we were talking about North was musically, it kind of reminded me of almost like when Radiohead went electronic, just like,
oh yeah,
the Johnny Greenwood, you know, experimenting with a lot of, you know, that kind of stuff, that it was producing just a very, I don't know. I think I've used atmospheric already to describe, but just that kind of vibe. And now that you said doing that and the fact that these followed each other, that makes a little bit of sense, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think even in the writing process, I wanted to play with that more, sounds and I guess, like, you know, just to use the word, like, lush, like a lushness,
yeah,
a lush quality to atmospheric, kind of ambient elements, because we're not an ambient. I mean, we are. We have ambient. Ambient is certainly, I think, within our descriptors, but, you know, we're not, you know, a band you're going to put on and like meditate to, you know. So
no, not so much.
Yeah. So all that to say, I love bringing those elements into our sound. So that felt like a song where, again, it's simple. It's what, four chords, three chords, I think. And I love, even on the I think when we were writing that record and writing that song, we were listening to some. I know it's kind of became a trend on YouTube, like songs slowed down like 1,000 times, you know. Like,
okay.
These, you know, so yeah. There was, I didn't think there was this Aphex Twin song. I'm not remembering. Maybe it's called Avril 14th, or I don't know how to pronounce it. Anyway, I think it's a piano song of theirs, and it's slowed down 1,000 times, and it's beautiful. Just these, like, it just sounds gorgeous. And so Beaver had that idea in the studio for slowing down, like playing like a 3-note guitar accompaniment and then slowing it down. And Will did that. So the way it kind of came together sonically, and the way that I talked about Grist for the Malady Mill, referencing REM, another favorite band of mine, again, particularly the more the early or the mid years, would be The Cure. And for some reason, elements of that song and a couple other songs on this record, again, not that your brain would automatically go there, but that's in my writing. And I think even as we were writing together, there was some intentionality, or maybe that word was, or that band was probably brought up as, you know, as a reference point for some of the parts, you know. Again, not like an obvious correlation, but another band that I grew up with, and certainly Mike and Aaron and the other dudes too, but again, growing up with them, I knew that was like a big influence on us. So it was more sonically. I mean, I love what Aaron did with it, but I think sonically this song just captured an element of the kind of music I like. And I think sometimes people hear our band and then talk to me, you know, I love talking to people at shows and stuff, and maybe assume that I'm just like into heavy music or like metal, you know, and some guys in the band are to some degree. I'm not. I love, again, the stuff I was just telling you, like the REMs, the Cures, the Smiths, all that kind of, you know, those kind of bands, and a lot of indie and punk stuff too. But the harsher elements of hardcore metal they're just not up my alley.
They're
kind of
lost on you. Yeah.
Yeah, they're lost on me. And you know, no disrespect to those bands, but it's funny. Sometimes I think people just will approach me talking about music, assuming because our band has heavy elements that's, you know, maybe like more in my wheelhouse, but. So all that to say, so to reference,
we're
a band
kindred
like
spirits,
Cure.
Greg. I'm
all right on. Right,
I'm kind of the same way.
Okay,
I can appreciate that type of music. I just have to be in the right mood for it, and
sure.
I typically
sure.
go more for melody and, you know, that kind of thing. That's just that's my bread and butter. Either that or just you know, old school 3-chord punk. You know.
Yeah. Totally. So I'll have to say I get excited when those elements make their way into our music, and I wouldn't want to shoehorn them in an unnatural way, but when they find their way in, it excites me. So that's why
cool.
I pick Pale Horse.
All right, so song number 2 from the Pale Horses trio, we've got Mexican War Streets, which really incorporates that, is it the Quiet Loud Quiet? So it's like reverse Pixies, because I think they were like Loud Quiet Loud.
Loud Quiet Loud, yeah.
Yeah, so,
sort of like the anti-chorus. Or like
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
By the path I lead, the passing of time, the pouring of tea, are all I've lately seen. Oh, my soul. Until the temporal bridge be burned, till our anchor stops. Flats where the upscale go, I tremble at the thought.
I tremble at the thought.
Funny that my relationship with this one grew because again, man, I should know. And if Beaver or Mike end up listening to this, I'm trying to think who brought the initial riff. I think it was Beaver with this one. But anyway, it was a song when we first were writing it. I thought it was cool, and I liked the riff, but it wasn't that exciting to me, I guess, or it was, but it didn't really jump out maybe until Aaron did his thing, or maybe it started coming together in the studio. It was just kind of like, hey, this is cool, and it sounds like us. But when we started to, I think even more so in the studio, like kind of mess with some of those dynamics a little more dramatically, I thought it just had the way the energies shift in that song are so exciting to me. So performing it is certainly a highlight. And then I don't feel like, you know, I think when I think of bass, I think of how it serves the song. I don't try to necessarily like stand out. But I remember with that song, there was something, I remember it particularly being in my head when we were writing it in I think in Mike's basement at the time. And I was like, I'm going to try to push myself a little bit. You know, I kind of have a comfort zone with how I write. And sometimes I go with one of the first things that comes to me, like, if you know, but this one, I kind of want to find the song a little bit. So mm-hmm. I just remember personally having a little bit of wrestling with it in a good way, where I felt like I came out of it almost like a better bass player a little bit. And then at the ending part, it's one of those, I don't like have a lot of these moments. Not that I'm self-deprecating. Well, I am self-deprecating, but I'm not, I don't necessarily like talk down my playing. Nor do I really talk it up. So I think the end of that song, I'm like, well, I really like what I did there. Like if I heard that, I'd be like, you know, the outro, I'd be like, that's a cool bass part. And I don't say that about much. So I think they, you know, and that's a little bit of a pat on the back to myself, but
a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, so that's just one of those songs where I kind of feel like, well, I'm like, really, I think I pushed myself. And I remember even, I think Mike saying when the song was done, he that really stood out to him. And that like meant a lot to me as my friend and bandmate.
And mutual need and the loud desperation of social routine. Rock of salvation, lightly esteemed. Distance is surging like oceans between us. Suspended with strings of rotating wheels. Near magnificent screens of Carnegie steel. Representation, our fashionable theme. And unfathomably powerful forces like oceans between us. We have all the signs we need. We decide not to read.
Well, we're going to take it on home. We got the last song, song number 11, Magic Lantern Days, which is a very pretty song and is a nice out for this playlist, I believe.
Awesome.
Hail the blessed atomic horn unto the earth, the palm is born, the pebble bed reactor core up to the sky ascends. Hail the blessed atomic sea, its mouth in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, whose lips untouched with blasphemy our glowing eyes attend. Thank you.
Yeah, Magic Lantern Days, it's related to me to Pale Horse and how I feel about when I was talking about incorporating elements or influences from different bands. Because, again, I know when the finished product comes, it's not, it doesn't translate this way, but I guess anybody who creates, or maybe specifically in this instance that's listening, writes music, you know, we might have this reference point in our mind for what we're, for what's informing what we're bringing to a song. And even though we're maybe not trying to emulate that band, or that it's going to, the end product's going to be that, there's like that DNA is in there. And so for Magic Lantern Days, it also has that Cure DNA. So not only getting to use some of those lush sounds like the Omnicord again. And I think even when we wrote this, I had the sample from Song of the Wren in my looper, because I would do some geology shows here and there. So I had it in my looper when I play guitar, and I used it for this song. We were writing it, and it kind of deviated from the chord structure a little bit. So I had to kind of go home and redo it just with a C chord instead of these back and forths. But
okay.
But I liked, like, again, bringing that element from a song I had written a couple years ago for geology. Like, oh, this sound will be cool over this, like, distorted kind of driving bass line that's very simple, but it reminded me of it, in my mind, it reminded me of like something off of Cure Disintegration or something. It had this sort of just driving thing with Ricky's, the way Ricky's drums were kind of driving along. So it just kind of was chugging, you know, and then adding this kind of, you know, ethereal atmospheric element to it with the Omnicord was just, again, felt very Cure-like to me. And then, so it already had that, and I remember feeling excited when it was coming together in the writing room. And then I loved what Aaron did with it. So even, like, again, I loved it as an instrumental, but then when we got back his melody, and then getting to, you know, to harmonize with that in the studio and kind of create this layered vocal in the choruses was really fun too.
And I will say, you guys are definitely a band that needs to be experienced live to really, I guess, get a full scope of what's going on and what you're hearing. Once you've seen it, you can listen to the records and, I don't know, like, you have that lens to kind of filter things through, and you can kind of, you get it a little bit more. Because the first time I heard Me Without You, I worked at a record store, and Roy Culver, A&R guy, used to send me all the promo stuff or for any Tooth & Nail release.
Okay.
And I got AB Live, and I threw it on, and either I wasn't ready for it, or I don't know, something, it did not click.
Yeah.
And I listened to it like once or twice, and I put it in the used racks and was like, somebody else is going to dig this. Fast somebody forward else. 2 months, I go to Cornerstone and this, yeah, it would have been like right after the album came out.
Yeah.
I'm from Central Illinois. So Cornerstone's like, okay, within an hour from me. So,
oh, okay, perfect.
I got to sleep in my own bed during Cornerstone.
That's, oh man, you one of the lucky ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes I would have bands come over and whatnot. Overcome broke my buddy's toilet 1 year. just in case they're listening and forgot about that. So yeah, you know, some good times. Cornerstone was that was how I spent the 4th of July week, you know, for years. And I go, I think it was Tooth & Nail Day, and it was early in the day, and because it was like, we're going to put on all these new signees. New bands,
really. yeah. We don't get these midnight sets yet.
So here come these guys in black turtlenecks and, suit coats, and Illinois summers are so humid and muggy, and especially that time of year, and you're in a tent in the middle of the day. The heat index is probably near 110 in there. And
You can lift your arm in a cornerstone tent and feel like 2 degrees colder above like the head level. Yeah,
exactly. And they're dripping sweat before they've even started playing. And I'm like sympathizing for these guys. Like, what? Do they not know what they were getting into with this weather?
Why are they torturing themselves?
And then they start and my jaw like hit the ground. And I was like, oh my God, what is this? Like, and it blew me away. It was one of my all-time favorite sets at Cornerstone. Awesome. And the next day, I went back and I took that album out of the used rack, and it's been in my collection since. Yes. And then upgraded to vinyl, and I was a fan from there out. I had to witness it, and then it was like, I get this, and I'm in. And from then on, I became I would tell anybody that would listen, and I'd play it at the store, and it was just like, just listen, just check this out.
Right on.
I get that it's not always easily accessible, but it's, you give it a chance, and seeing you guys live is an experience, and I hope everybody will go out next year. This year was supposed to be the farewell tour.
Yeah.
And then life happens. And now you guys are trying to reschedule things for next year, and fingers crossed this can happen. But yes, everybody, just go see Me Without You on the next, tour. Hopefully they come to a city near you. I'm sure Chicago or St. Louis is going to be on the lineup at some point. I will try to be at one or the other.
Awesome.
And also, the new Geology record that we mentioned came out July 3rd, Light of the Risen Year. We didn't play any songs from it, but I implore you to go listen. And that is on Spotify. So if you guys want to check that out, by all means, after you listen to the companion playlist, which all you have to do is just type in Greg's name and then my personal mixtape after it, and the playlist will appear, and you can enjoy it in the comfort of your car or home or wherever you enjoy your music. But Greg, I want to thank you so much for sitting and talking music with me. This was a pleasure, and I have only had communications with you through messages and text messages, and you never really know if you're going to click with somebody, especially over a phone interview.
Sure.
It can be very tense, and I've had some that I'm just like, oh, that went horrible. And like, I bum myself out, like I could have made that go so much better. And this was great. I'm sure you and I could have talked for hours, but we all have things to do. But thank you so much again for taking the time out of your Saturday to sit and talk music. And hopefully everybody that listens enjoyed hearing the stories behind the fantastic work that you have created over the past 20 years.
Thank you so much for the kind words, Dustin. Yeah, it was a joy for me to do this. And like you said, we could certainly keep talking. I think my 4-year-old is downstairs waiting for me to lay down with him so he can fall asleep.
Sure.
But no, this was wonderful. It was a pleasure. And thanks for making the time. And I may have said too much at times, but maybe you'll
better to say too much than not enough.
Right on.
That's what editing is for, Greg. I will take care of the rest. So yeah, hopefully I will see you at one of the Me Without You shows down the road, and just keep that Geology music coming. We'll keep listening. You just keep writing.
Thank you so much. And yeah, certainly let me know what show you'll be at, and I would love to, hugs or high fives or on the on the docket for
an
next
elbow
year.
Bump at the least.
Yeah, an elbow bump at least. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. Well, Greg, you take care, and thanks for joining us on My Personal Mixtape.
You got it, man. I'll talk to you later, brother.
Thanks again to Greg for joining me for my personal mixtape. Don't forget to check out the companion Spotify playlist so you can hear all those songs, with the exception of some of those geology tracks. You can find those on the Bandcamp website. Be sure to follow them on all social media and follow us as well at Drunken Lullabies Podcast. If you would like to contact the show, you can email us at drunkenlullabiespodcast@yahoo.com. Joining me next time is going to be Dustin Addis from The Forecast. They're a local hometown favorite, and Dustin doesn't really do interviews too often. It's probably been close to a decade since we last chatted, and I'm looking forward to catching up with an old friend from the Peoria scene. Until next time, this is Dustin saying, may your music be loud and your beers be cold. We'll see you next time. And I can't hide it.